Welcome to the CEN Show, the voice of the world community. The Community Education Network is a team of educators that has a concern about our world community and the direction that it's headed in. Therefore, we take on the philosophy of each one teach one to aid the effort of self and collective improvement. I am your host, Rasaki Mascani. Tonight's guest is more like a team member. She is Miss Sandra Rogers, wife of our honorable team member, Peter Rogers. I am pleased to be affiliated with both of them. Sandra did a show for us on April 14, 2021. It was exceptionally informative as it relates to community health in Los Angeles. The show can be accessed on YouTube for the video and the website communityeducationnetwork.com. It is a must hear. Good evening, Ms. Sandra. How are you? And please begin your presentation.
All right. Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to be here again with you guys. Turn this down. Okay. Okay, so you know what I was thinking? I was talking to Rigo, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, because everything I talked about last time, he said, we talked about. So I was thinking this month is Women's Month. Everybody know that? Everybody know that, right? Okay. This is Women's Month, and so I decided to talk about women and health disparities. So I have a PowerPoint presentation that I want to share, but the first thing I want to do is just read you a woman's story of medical neglect in the issues of racism with Black women, okay? So it's kind of long, so I'm just going to kind of give some points of what she's dealing with. So she was having some chest pains on her right side and in her back, and it was so uncomfortable that she was unable to sit down or lie down. She was in so much pain. So the next morning, she went to her nearest urgent care facility. It was during COVID, by the way, okay? So she was asked to wait in the car because she reported chest pains and shortness of breath. She waited for an hour without being seen by a doctor. She was told to go to another urgent care location because there was no one who could read a chest x-ray if she needed one. She never saw a provider and no vitals were taken. At the second facility, she was greeted with frustration and hostility because of the staff. They didn't appreciate her being sent to them, okay? So they expressed their displeasure on her arrival, again, presenting chest pains, shortness of breath. She was told to wait in her car until they could do a rapid COVID test, okay? Now, her husband is a doctor, okay? And he and his daughters were waiting with her for over an hour until someone gave her a COVID test. She said that the COVID test was, the nurse jabbed the test up her nose so far that it caused her to yell and cry. She said she had had several COVID tests before and none of them had ever been that bad. But she said the nurse was hostile. The nurse was mad because she was there. This was a white nurse. And when she yelled and screamed and flinched, the nurse said, "You need to learn to relax." After the test was negative, the provider came to the car to assess. After a thorough explanation of symptoms by her and her husband, who's a Black doctor, the doctor looked in her nose and told her that it was congested. And he gave her a diagnosis of a post-nasal drip and told her she needed to blow her nose. He stated that the pain in her chest was because of sinuses that were draining at night. Okay, so They asked for a chest x-ray. The doctor did the chest x-ray. He said he'd do that and he'd be happy to do it. He says, as long as you don't mind being hit with a couple of doses of radiation, and as long as she wasn't pregnant. So they, when they were checking her oxygen on her finger, it wasn't working. And the doctor said to her, sometimes it doesn't work on colored fingers. When she entered the facility, he put her in a room. He warmed up the x-ray machine, left her standing in the room unattended. When the x-ray was completed, after several attempts by the nurse, she asked the provider to explain the cloudiness on the x-ray. I told him it was hard to see the lower part of my x-ray. He said, well, that's because of your breast. The provider went on to say that he's not a radiologist and there would be nobody there to read it for an hour. He sent her home, documented that the chest x-ray was clear. Okay. So with the lack of the negligence that her husband was so upset, he reached out to the clinical director of the urgent care and told them how they were treated. 2 days later, the director made arrangements for her to come back to be seen at a third urgent care. Less than an hour after she arrived, she was immediately sent to the ER where she had a CAT scan. I was CAT scan, echocardiogram, and full blood work. The ER doctor informed her that she had a pulmonary embolism in her lower lobe of the right lung, pneumonia, and an infraction in her right lung, which resulted in that part of her lung tissue dying. The first two facilities that had sent her away in critical condition. She spent the next 4 days in the hospital with 24 hours IV, antibiotics, and blood thinner. So that's just one woman's story. There's lots of stories. And the other thing I wanna read before I start the PowerPoint presentation is that 400 hospitals in the United States showed that Black patients with heart disease received older, cheaper, or more conservative treatments than their white counterparts. Black patients were less likely to receive coronary bypass operations and angioplasty. After surgery, they were discharged earlier from the hospital than their white patients at a stage when discharge is inappropriate. The same goes for other illnesses. Black women are less likely than white women to receive radiation therapy in conjunction with a mastectomy. In fact, they are less likely to receive mastectomies. Perhaps more disturbing is that Black patients are more likely to receive less desirable treatments. The rate at which Black patients have their limbs amputated is higher than those of white patients. Additionally, Black patients suffering from bipolar disorder are more likely to be treated with antipsychotics, despite evidence that medications have long-term negative effects or not effective. Okay, so gonna share my screen. Okay, can everyone see this? Yes, okay. How do I get the participants to disappear from the side? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, guys, hold on. No.
No.
I don't like that. Mm-hmm.
Maybe take that out.
I'm coming, guys. Okay. All right. So everybody can see, you can see me? Okay. So this slideshow is by Laisha McKinley Beach. She is a mental health professional out of Atlanta. And I was able to hear her do this presentation. And it was very impactful. So I reached out to her and asked her, hey, you know, do you mind me sharing your PowerPoint? She was totally cool with it. So I would like to thank her personally for this slideshow. Okay, so let's start. So the objectives are to address the role of cultural humility in successful health outcomes for Black women, discuss the importance of partnership versus dictatorship with clinical providers during medical visits with Black women, and to provide an overview of health disparities among Black women and strategies to address them. Throughout this presentation, we will use the term Black to refer to people of the Africa diaspora. Okay, so we can skip this one. Sorry, guys. All right. Who is she? Include in the chat Black women from your circle. So I'm talking to you guys who were gone too soon because of health disparities. You don't have to use their names, but identify the role that she played in your life. Does anyone want to discuss this? Any woman in your life that you feel gone too soon because of health disparities?
I mean, I can go ahead and just jump in and say, you know, I mean, my best friend who was 57 years old when she passed, or 56 years old when she passed, from cancer, metastatic breast cancer. So that's definitely one that I would like to bring up, you know, aside even from my mother who passed last year at the age of 78, still feeling like, you know, she had more time to give, but due to emphysema, diabetes, the COPD, you know, we lost her. And I, again, feel like that was gone too soon.
Thank you, Lisa. Anyone else?
Alexis, yes. You want to jump in?
Yes. This is Professor Amin Ra. At Cal State Long Beach, there was a sister student named Sheila Ringer. Worked to Long Beach Memorial. She had went to the doctor earlier and she had told him, you know, she had a problem with her boyfriend, but she went to the doctor and they said that she had a cyst in her uterus or something like that. And so she called me and said she needed to go to the doctor about 12:30 at night. And so I said, okay, I'll get up, I'll check with everybody. I got up and I went over there to help her because she was living by herself. Mm-hmm. And her mother lived in Detroit. So I picked her up, took her to Long Beach Memorial. And when we got to Long Beach Memorial, before that, as a matter of fact, I didn't pick her up. I called the paramedics and they came, the ambulance came. And then I explained to them that, you know, you need to check her for, you know, internal bleeding because she had fainted before I got there. That's what happened. So anyway, I take her there and they put her in a room and they never went back and checked on her and she bled internally to death. Her parents ended up suing, got about $10,000 because it took almost 7 years for it to get settled. But that was one of the worst things, one of the worst situations I ever heard of with regards to a hospital putting you in the, you go in the emergency, and, you know, and then they put you in a room to be seen, and then they forget about you. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they would have done that if she was a white student.
I agree. Anyone else want to share? Well, I can share my experience with my mother. My dad died in 1983, and my mother went into like a depression where she would constantly go to her doctor just crying and crying because she was depressed. She was married to him for 34 years. He was 20 years older than her. So he was like a husband and a father figure to her, a father that she didn't really have a great relationship with. So it was a huge loss for her. And what the doctor did was, you know, he got tired of her crying. So he went on and sent her to therapy, which is fine. And he just started giving her medication, just started medication after medication after medication. I mean, they would talk to her for a little while, but they would give her medication. She got addicted to the medication. She became a person who started drug seeking. And when I went to talk to the therapists who were giving the medication to her, their response to me was, how dare you question what we're doing for your mother? Your mother is depressed. Your mother has been diagnosed manic. And we're doing what we can to help your mother. I told them, well, I disagree. I think that, she's depressed because she's grieving. She's not depressed because she's manic, or if there is any type of mental dysfunction, the medication is not helping, it's making it worse. Long story short, she stayed on medication after medication. They got to a point where she was in drug rehabs, out in and out of drug rehabs. It was, you know, just a horrible, horrible time. But the therapist would not take responsibility for the role they played in making her or assisting her in getting addicted to these medications. And the sad part about it is she died in that addictive state, and she lived 20 years after my dad died. But her life was always, it never was the same. And it was just a sad narrative because the medical, the doctors didn't do what they needed to do for her. And when they kind of denied her being addicted, because back then they were saying, well, you know, it's prescription drugs. She can't be, you can't be addicted to prescription drugs. It's not like she's out, you know, on the corner getting crack. These are drugs. These are, you know, pharmaceutical medications, you know. And back then it was the 80s and into the 90s, but now they're talking about how drugs, prescription drugs are dangerous and how you can get addicted. But back then, the doctors just didn't want to take responsibility for that. So I feel that the mental health system failed my mother. They took somebody who was grieving the loss of her husband and turned that person into somebody who ended up being a drug seeker and couldn't get off the drugs. And the mental issues that maybe she did have, you know, with the drugs, it didn't help. So, it's a sad narrative. It really is, but it happens a lot. It wasn't happening a lot, or I didn't know a lot about it when she was going through it. But now, I mean, that, you know, that's the talk of the town, you know, the dangers of prescription drugs and things like that. So, so that's my story. And I appreciate you guys for sharing. Does anyone else want to share before we continue? All right. Next slide. It's saying where we've been is impacting our health outcomes now. And there's a saying here by Frederick Douglass, we are not judged by the height You are not judged by the height you have risen, but from the depth you have climbed. And, you know, Black people have been climbing and climbing ever since. A little bit of history she has back here. You see a little newspaper editor, whatever it is, saying the Freedmen's Bureau, an agency to keep the Negro in idleness at the expense of the white man. Twice vetted by the president and made a law by Congress. And then it says, former slaves are now dying in high numbers. Bodies are littering the streets. And now it is a public health crisis because it's affecting the majority population. So the first federal healthcare program is established called the Freedmen's Bureau Medical Division. Poorly staffed, lack of necessary supplies, bedding, medicine, enough smallpox vaccines. And then they have the theory for poor health among Black communities receiving government support. The high death rate is nature taking its course. Black people are not dying from lack of basic necessity. They're dying because they are biologically inferior. Of course, this is white people telling. Inferior to white people and ill-suited for freedom. Black people are going extinct, and to provide any resources to prevent that would be wasteful and foolish. The theory became mainstream and was argued in the House of Representatives. So, of course, a lot of our issues, our health disparities, our mental health, a lot of these things come from slavery. A lot of the way we think today comes from slavery. You know, people keep talking about, oh, you got to get rid of that slave mentality. Well, sometimes slave mentality can be in our DNA. For example, you have a Black woman and you have a white woman, and they're sitting and they're watching their two daughters do gymnastics. And the white woman turns, and the Black woman turns to the white woman and says, oh my God, your daughter is doing so much better. She's, you know, really improving, and she's doing all types of flips. And, you know, I mean, she's just doing a great job. And the white woman turns to the Black woman and says, oh, well, thank you so much. But, you know, your daughter is the one who is just doing magnificently. I mean, oh my God, she is just phenomenal. I mean, she's better than most of the girls that's on the team. And I mean, everybody's just so impressed with your daughter. And the Black woman says, oh no, you know, she needs to improve a little bit more. There's some things that she could work on. That comes from back in the day, in slave days, where the mother is in the field with her daughter. And here comes Massa saying, oh, Sarah, your daughter's looking really good now. She's growing up to be a nice looking young girl. What does the mother say? Oh, no, Massa. My daughter's not, oh, no, Massa. She's not doing, oh, she's, no, she has some issues. She, you know, she's not well. She has a lot of illnesses. She's not strong at all, Massa, no. I'm sorry, a lot of us, we tend to do that. We tend to downplay our pride. We tend to downplay how phenomenal we are as Black people. We downplay a lot. And that is real talk. And it does come from that type of mentality. We don't want it to be in our DNA, but it is in our DNA. And it does come up. If anyone wants to interrupt, you're not interrupting. So if anyone wants to chime in on things I'm saying, I have no problem with that.
Okay. I would like to say
something. Yeah, I had something I wanted to comment to. Yeah, I just want to know, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You said, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, the downplay. Yeah, is that good or bad?
What do you think?
You know, it depends on the situation, I would say. But okay. Overall, I think it's a good thing to downplay your strength to white people.
Well, explain that, please.
I want to jump in.
Let them explain that. Go ahead. Example for that one. Good one. Brother Doctor, can you expound on that, please?
Oh, I was, you know, my career, I kind of downplayed my strength and it worked to my advantage, you know. And I saw the people that exploited their strength and they were always getting passed over or, you know, they were, you know, they're the ones that kind of looked at. It was just going under the radar. Going under the radar. To me, that's a good thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else?
I wanted to say something, but Miss Kelly wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say that I think that in a way that can be a bad thing only because I have an example. So my younger daughter played soccer at UC Irvine and she was big and strong and tall and, you know, was an exceptional athlete. And I feel like we downplayed a lot of the things it is that she was capable of doing to take the pressure off of her. So to the doctor's point, I understand what he's saying is that sometimes it's better to be under the radar. But I also think that we limited some of the things, the greatness that she was or that she, you know, she doesn't play there anymore. But I feel like there's a lot of times where we downplayed it to take a lot of the, you know, the fingers at her, things that were pointed at her, the pressure that was put on her, because she was one of the only Black people, you know, like that was playing on this team that was quite visible for the world to see. And that went even back to when they were younger, when they were like in middle school, again, big, strong, fast or whatever. And I feel like we downplayed a lot of her abilities because we were trying to take her out of the radar. Why, Sandra? I mean, why would we do that? Or why did we feel as though that's something we had to do to shelter her from the eyes and, you know, the scrutiny and different things like that, that I feel like Black athletes who are in these white environments that they experienced all the time. We saw that. And again, at UC Irvine, that's a whole different story. So, I mean, I'm just saying that, yeah, it is a twofold thing, but I do feel like, why did she have to bear the brunt of being on the forefront all the time, you know, when it came to different things like that? So I guess it is a twofold thing. Alexis, I don't know if you want to jump in and put your two cents in. I guess not.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment.
Okay.
I think that it's true. It's really true that we suffer from slavery still. It definitely is happening. And the example that you gave about the master and the lady and her daughter, I think that could have been good to downplay it because that master could have been coming after that girl.
Right.
You know, it's a shame that we have to be so strategic in what we're doing due to the fact of slavery and racism, white supremacy. We have to be so creative in our thinking at times so we can sometimes get to a position where we want to go. And that's what I think Brother Doctor was talking about. But it is true. We suffer from slave mentality because I can see it in our kids daily when I'm at school teaching. And it's tough to swallow. But this is why we're here doing what we're doing right now. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you when the master said, you know, oh, Sarah, your daughter is looking at, yeah, you know, either the master was looking at the daughter for a sexual thing, which, you know, that was normal back then, or to sell or to snatch her away from her mother, you know, who knows what it was, but, you know, slaves always had to fight and to figure things out. You know, they thought we was ignorant, didn't have no sense, but I mean, the slaves were smart. They knew how to do things. They knew how to say what to say, what not to say, you know. But I agree. Yeah. Those types of things, that's when if the master was looking at the child, then either the child's going to be raped or the child's going to be sold, you know, and the mother is going to, of course, downplay it because she doesn't want any of that to happen.
Appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly, and thank you for bringing this up, because when you start dealing with the Holocaust of enslavement, and we were enslaved, we were African people, we weren't slaves because some people just think as soon as you say slave, it means black.
Right.
But no, we were African people that were enslaved. Prior to that, from ancient history, which you deal with Imhotep, the first physician on the earth, and opened up the first hospital. And you go through the history of African communities, they always had someone that was expertise in remedies. And then many of them gathered food and prepared their own food. They didn't have all these fast food things. So their health was mostly personally maintained. When we got into the Holocaust of enslavement, they would call the veterinarian when we got sick, not the doctor. So they treated us as property and animals. And we even slept with the animals. I mean, in the barns and things of this nature, in some plantations. And so, you know, that's why we had to come up with ways not only to heal ourselves from disease and hurt, because if you couldn't work, they'll kill you. They're poison. Mm-hmm. So the issue was, you know, we tried to save those that you could, or that they allow you to save. You know, because when you got to a certain age and you couldn't work, they just poisoned you. So my point is that health disparities extend through our history of racism, of course, but also of the inhumane and psychopathic mentality of the European that would deny health to human beings, or circumvent them, or do not see them as human beings. And then to our parents, as we went through Reconstruction and all that, always develop home remedies with regards to treatment. Most of us, up until the 50s, was born at home with a midwife. Most of us, our family used 3/6 alcohol remedies around the house. Drink baking soda to get rid of your gas, and all kind of stuff that they came up with that they learned text and there. Health is always an important thing and a personal thing. But one of the reasons we had to try our best to stay healthy, because if we were not healthy and could not perform, could not pick that cotton the way they wanted, could not work during the Holocaust of enslavement, we would be physically whipped or beat or killed. So health became a very important thing, spiritually, physically, and mentally, during the Holocaust of enslavement. That's what all that was saying. The disparity came with segregation and racism, as you pointed out, of them treating us like animals, and white doctors not wanting to touch a black person. White nurses not wanting, even the first hospital at one time we had 500 hospitals that were black. Now we only got one. That's at Howard University. We had schools. I mean, we were segregated, so we learned, we built these schools and got the skills to heal ourselves and to treat ourselves. And then things have changed immensely to this day, because we don't have enough black doctors, we don't have enough black nurses, and we don't have enough people opening up medical centers and health centers, because we keep relying on the system that's racist and discriminatory. And so until we see that developing these institutions are to our benefit, not because of segregation, but because that's how we're going to get the best health and trusted health and people that know our bodies and know our situations from that standpoint. I didn't mean to take so much time, but anyway.
No, that's good. That's good. That was important to say. Anybody else? Okay. So they're talking about, this is talk about birth control, about Fannie Lou Hamer and Henrietta Lacks, who everybody knows those stories. Birth control. Negroes don't want children they take care of, but we are afraid to trust you when you're offered help, as so often turned out to be exploitation. So this is a Black social worker speaking on a family planning in 1972. Okay, so this is health disparities among women. So some health disparities among women is cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease kills nearly 50,000 Black women. 49% have heart disease. Only 1 in 5 Black women believe she is personally at risk. Only 58% of Black women are aware of the signs and symptoms of a heart attack. Black women are less likely than white women to be aware that heart disease is the leading cause of death. Contributing factors: diabetes, smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, physical inactivity, obesity, and family history of heart disease. This is I like this slide because basically it's like what a lot of women and men too hear, a blood disorder. Black women are disproportionately impacted by anemia, deficiency of red blood cells, or of hemoglobin in the blood, and sickle cell anemia. And a lot of Black people, women have heard this a lot. I don't know about men, but I know when I talk to a lot of women, when they go into the hospital or go into the emergency room and they talk about the pain that they're in and they're saying, you know, about these things like that, a lot of the response from the medical staff is, you're not in pain, you're just looking for a fix. You know, because a lot of medical staff believe a Black person coming in talking about, oh, I'm in pain, I need this, they just drug seeking. And that's that. You know, so you actually have people telling people, you know, you ain't no pain, you just looking for you're looking for a fix, looking for your next high. That's what you're doing. Let's stop. When actually you actually have, you know, people who are actually sick and having health disparities and health issues. It is estimated that Black women are nearly 4 times more likely to die while pregnant or within 1 year postpartum than their white and Latina counterparts. These disparities are seen across educational and socioeconomic status among Black women. So it don't matter if you don't have a college degree or you have a PhD. The disparity and these issues are still hitting Black women. Doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. Clinical factors. Some of the leading causes of maternal morbidities, babies dying, resulting in pregnancy-associated death, occur more Black women. Hemorrhaging, infection, pulmonary and embolisms, pregnancy associated with hypertension. Non-clinical factors. The quality of hospitals. Black women give birth in lower quality hospitals or hospitals with higher rates of maternal morbidity. Some research has found that if Black women gave birth at the same hospital as white women, Black severe maternal morbidity rate would decrease by 47.7% from 4.2 to 2.9. I think that's rather deep. Okay. So this is a discussion on mental health. Racial discrimination is a toxic, uncontrollable, and unpredictable stressor that is associated not only with poor physical health, but also with psychological stress. Cultural influence on mental health. Take it to the Lord and leave it there. Stigma influence on mental health. I'm not crazy. Therapy is for white people. I know I have stories about that. I have family members who have stories about that. You have somebody who's experiencing a mental breakdown, mental stress, that actually needs therapy, that actually maybe need medication. And what do they say? Oh, just pray it away. Just keep praying. Take them to the altar. Take him to, just pray it away. It'll be all right. You know, you could be at a dinner table with a child who you can look at them and see that they're not eating and that they're anorexic. And you may have the mother say, well, you know what? This kid needs help. And maybe the father or somebody else will say, no, she don't need help. She is going to sit right here at this table and she's going to finish this damn food and she's going to stop tripping, you know? So a lot of Black people believe that going to the therapist is taboo. You know, you don't do that. We don't share our problems. This is in-house stuff. You know, this stays in the family. We don't need to go outside and tell people that our kid is tripping or my wife is seeing things or my husband is having some alcoholism problems and problems with his, you know, where he's tripping. You know, that stays in-house. We don't share that type of stuff. And mental health is real. Being Black in America can cause mental health within itself. The racism, the discrimination, the being driving while Black, being murdered while Black, being profiled while Black, you know, just being disrespected while Black.
Brent.
All these things, Carol, you're not muted, Carol, I hear you. All these things can work on your mental, Black people's mental health as a whole. And it's something huge, and it's something that I feel needs to be discussed more. You know, you hear a lot about depression and anxiety and things like that. So, you know, mental health and Black health goes hand in hand. Anybody you want to say anything on that?
Well, I just wanted to, for a second, Alexis, I would like for you to at least address this and tell them what you do and where you are, because I think this is right in your wheelhouse. At least you can introduce a little bit of what you're seeing.
Just for everybody, that's my mom. Lisa Kelly is my mom. I'm Alexis Kelly. So all the, will she talk? She's talking to me. I'm her daughter. I'm in D.C., I am a behavioral health clinical supervisor at a Black nonprofit organization that provides both mental health and medical services to primarily a Black population. what you're speaking on, that's Auntie Sandra, is the mental health that of the racial discrimination, the cultural stigma of the population that I serve on a daily basis. And it is... Now, these are folks that are, on the one hand, are coming in voluntarily for services, but there's also folks that are coming in through the court system. And so you have an added layer of disparity because they've already been involved with criminal justice and for the most part self-reported as unfairly or unjustly involved. But they're now seeing me under a court-mandated condition. And so when we think about the Black American experience and the impact it has on mental health, certainly there's going to be challenges. But when you add the layer of already having a criminal now background, it makes the job taxing because now I'm trying to have folks open up to the idea that this process, this mental health therapeutic process, can be a benefit if you work with me and not against me. But recognizing that for these particular individuals in their world, the system has worked against them. So it can be difficult to trust even your own Black organization that's here for you, here to support you. It's hard to trust that when the court said you have to be here in the first place. And if you're not here, we'll put you in jail. So, I mean, it can create a really negative tone to something that is already highly stigmatized within the Black community. And even for folks, like conversely, even for folks that are voluntarily seeking services, I've been doing this for 6 years now, you start to see developments of pattern. The folks that are coming in because they want the system to, you know, work for them because it hadn't worked. And so then they start to develop these dependencies on the fact that if I go to mental health, then I can keep my government benefits. Then I can get this housing. Then I can get this extra income. versus I can get mental health and actually do better and thrive and create a better life. Unfortunately, the way the system is set up, it actually doesn't support that. It actually wants you to create more of a dependency on the systems in order for you to feel like this mental health is something to benefit. So it's just, there's a lot of different layers and problems as an employee within the system of mental health, but also of an advocate for mental health services. I've been told that sometimes my ideology is a bit too optimistic, a bit too ideal, because the reality of the situation is those who are coming in for services at the frequency that they're coming in aren't necessarily benefiting fully from the service because the application of the resources that we're trying to provide are minimal. But for those who would benefit from coming in for services, benefit from talking to a therapist, they don't come. So that's sort of the reality I face with the work that I do with mental health and the stigma of actually opening up, talking about problems, applying what we talk about, pushing through generational trauma, pushing through capitalistic barriers, overcoming those things are incredibly difficult, even with the best therapy in the world. And so it's no surprise, unfortunately, that we see that there's still a lack of engagement within the mental health service population.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. Anybody want to piggyback on that or add to that?
Well, I don't know if I should add to it. I think it was very eloquently spoken. Yeah. And I think one of the things that had come up earlier when we were talking about the need to suppress excellence, and I had a phrase that I had used for years, and I said, I am getting tired of having to be exemplary to tolerate their imperfections. And that is the biggest stress I find as a Black person and the universal trauma that Black people have had to endure in this country. There has always been this, the 7-to-1 rule. For every one bad comment you make to somebody, it takes 7 comments to get it back to somewhat square. Well, when you've had 400 years of false promises, broken promises, or partially filled promises at best, and every time you take 2 steps forward, they pull you back 3, that trauma never gets resolved. So it's no surprise that you would see a universal trauma amongst Black people in this country because we've never gotten a fair shake. And a couple of the brothers that we were talking last night, you know, you only attack that what you are afraid of or that which you are inferior of. But that takes a toll on us, as we see in the mental health as well as the physical health. And this is just something that I think we need to always keep in mind when we are looking at our brothers and sisters who have a problem. Understand, a lot of us are the ones that were able to get some help, had some support system to be able to overcome the trauma we are always walking in. If you're always walking on eggshells, you're going to always watch where you step. And that's the difference, a lot of it, between white and Black. They have the freedom to make mistakes where we feel we better be perfect. In fact, we better be twice as good. And you can't sustain something like that because it's an unrealistic goal. And that's all I want to add.
Can I add to that, Uncle Peter? Again, I think the best example I can give to really punctuate the point you're making in terms of having to feel as if you can live a life of perfection simply to make sure you don't get incarcerated. That's the clientele I see every day. Every day is the system against the world, you know, and the system breaking down the backs of mostly, predominantly, 99% of the clients that I'm serving through the criminal justice system are going to be Black males. As I share with them, and as the other providers share with them, a common issue right now is marijuana use for folks on federal probation. For right now, that's illegal. And what's happening is that folks are using the marijuana to cope with anxiety, to cope with stress, to help go to sleep, to help relax, to help socialize. So there's all these reasons as to why the use is occurring, but in the eyes of the law, it's still illegal. And that technically speaking, there are risks for reincarceration should the behavior continue. Now, on the one hand, I'm thinking these are folks who are coming in with armed robbery charges. Like, if they're smoking a little marijuana to go to bed, I mean, I'm trying to weigh it out. And they're coming from some of the clients I serve have served over 40, 50 years of incarceration. Okay. So most of their lifetime is spent in jail or prison. And so I'm looking at this big picture. And so I'm, as the mental health provider, trying to impress upon them, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is a new life you can create for yourself that doesn't have to be what you might have been just used to, in terms of some people are just used to serving time. They're used to doing the crime and doing the time. And my job is to try to instill hope that that doesn't have to be the definition of your character. However, my role in doing that is abutted with the idea that they're still under probation, which means they're still under state property. So then there's a very, very difficult fine line that I'm walking on a daily basis to say, hey, I hear where you're coming from, but because of the circumstances of how we're meeting, it's not a good enough reason as to why you're doing what you're doing. And we had to figure out, me, the mental health provider, the client, come together to say, hey, while this is the case, while you have a probation officer, you have got to do something different, because all they need is a reason. They only need a reason to lock you up or to bring you before the judge or to violate your conditions or to extend your probation. They just need a reason. And my job most of the time is just trying to encourage them not to give them the reason. We know you can go to jail. Many people, I have all the clients in the world that say, I don't mind smoking marijuana and go to send me to jail. I've been in jail my whole life. There's nothing new about it. But I can say, here you are, you're working full time, you're taking classes, you got a good, healthy relationship now, you're seeing things about yourself. Why do the time just because you know how, when you're actually doing much better? But when you're not used to that, when you're not encouraged to be more than what your circumstances are, when you're not used to hope, when you're not used to resources and support, you just get what you can get. And like I said, for some people, like you mentioned, there's this, is almost like this inferiority, and it's just good enough. I'm used to being hit across the back. That's nothing new. But the idea of being successful and thriving and not being involved in criminal justice and actually just living a normal life, that is so much scarier for people. And I'm just so thankful that I've been around enough to see the success stories. When I have a client telling me he's so happy, he's filing taxes for the first time and he's in his mid-30s because everything else has been illegal. Or if I have for the first time a client telling me he's angry, but he's not taking it out on humans because of murder charges. Instead, he's just realizing he can maybe eat a snack and just lay down. So, I mean, when I'm seeing that and I'm hearing that and I'm realizing that people can actually believe that although the world can feel against you, you can still rise, that's why I show up. And that is why I'm so happy this topic is being discussed, because it's needed. I tell pretty much everybody I serve, there is no diagnosis for being Black in America. But we do know it's a real lived experience. PTSD is commonly used to try to diagnose essentially a Black lived experience, but it's part of my job to also help them understand that we can take that power back little by little. And even working within a Black organization, Black board of directors, Black management, it's even reminding each other, we don't have to push each other down just to go up. We can really support one another as a collective, as a group, and see each other hopefully thrive.
Thank you, Lexi. That was great. Totally. Excellent. I guess she'll be on the next CEN. Okay, we got to pull her.
Hey, you already know that's going to happen.
Okay, yeah, you better write her name down. Okay, let me keep it pushing because I've been on for an hour. Okay, look, all right, let's keep it pushing. Another thing about maternal mental health, and this is for women. You'll always be my baby. So everybody knows the stories of Trayvon and Ahmaud and Breonna, you know. But that's also, I mean, as a mother, as a woman, we're talking about women and mental health right now. As far as that, you know, I mean, to lose a child, but to lose a child so violently, and I'm looking at the three pictures up here, only Ahmaud is the only person who I personally feel had any type of justice. You know, the three men that killed him are all in jail, but Trayvon Zimmerman, he probably somewhere in Florida eating In-N-Out, eating a steak. I don't know where he is. You know, Breonna, none of the police officers are sitting in jail or anything by that. Yeah, her mama got paid, but so what? Who gives a care about the money? She ain't got a child. So with, you know, mental health is so broad, and then to deal with the loss of a child, the violent loss of a child, the injustice of losing a child and not having any closure, that is also a part of mental health and mental health in women and mental health in men, because all these people who are in this picture had fathers. And as far as the men, you know, we see a lot of the women who are walking and talking and saying, but the men are standing back and their fathers, they're in pain. They've lost a son, they lost their daughter. So the mental toll on parenting, on Black parenting is crazy, you know? So that's one thing I want to hit on. Then I want to talk, even get into COVID. Recent research study looked at the impact of race and gender on COVID deaths in Georgia and Michigan. The study revealed that Black women are dying three times the rate of white and Asian men. The only group higher than Black women are men in this jurisdiction. So this is just a question to ask you guys about racial or gender differences that maybe you observed during the COVID pandemic. Does anybody want to touch on that? If not, we can keep going because we do have more slides, but this is just another thing if you wanted to for discussion. Racial or gender differences that any one of you have observed during the COVID pandemic. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Okay, so I don't know if you guys remember this or if you knew about this. This is a Black doctor, a physician, an MD, who had COVID. And she alleged that the treatment in the hospital was so bad that she knew she was going to die. And she stated on December 4th, this is how Black people get killed. When you send them home and they don't know how to fight for themselves. She posted on Facebook, on her Facebook page, and she was saying, I had to talk to somebody, maybe the media, to let people know how I'm getting treated up in this place. She said, I put forth and I maintain, if I was white, I wouldn't have to go through this. She also said that she no longer trusted the hospital that she was asking, and she was asking to be transferred. And she died on December 20th. And she said she was going to die. And her son said, my mom was legitimately very scared. I haven't seen my mom that scared in a long, long time. She was concerned by the lack of empathy from the doctor. She didn't feel like the doctor cared about her health or whether or not she was getting better. He adding that his mother would call him daily from IU North Hospital, often in pain and in tears. She kind of thought that if the thought of it as the doctor wanted her to get out of the hospital as soon as possible. And she was concerned about that. So she did leave the hospital, and she came back 12 hours after because she couldn't breathe. She had a fever of 103. Her blood pressure fell to 80 over 60, which normally blood pressure is 120 over 80. So this is an MD, a professional doctor, a physician who died, and it was all because she was Black.
Because they were white.
And because they were white, right.
Thank you.
Right. So the woman who developed this slide, she talks about cultural humility and declaring racism as a public health crisis, and that Black women need to be seen. So another question here is to the participants. Any other solutions? Her solutions were cultural humility, where doctors who are coming into medical school, doctors who are already doctors, nurses who are in nursing school, nurses who are already nurses, PAs, all of them, they need to take classes on cultural, the different types of culture they're dealing with, the reasons why Black people don't like to come to the doctor is because of how they're treated, because they're not empowered. And she says that one solution is to claim racism as a public health crisis, and that it is time to see Black women. Anything else anybody want to add?
Yeah, I would actually add this. I would say, you know, when she's saying that she should declare racism as a public health issue, I actually said you declare racism as a psychological disorder. Because one of the other things I was looking at, I was listening to what you had said about when you were looking at the pictures of Ahmaud Arbery and Trayvon and saying about them getting justice. Well, in our world, we talk about getting justice, meaning that they had a fair trial, and we think the person who was guilty actually was convicted and served the appropriate time. But, you know, in the quote-unquote white world, their justice is they're still alive. We need to stop settling. We talk about in church, you want to change your life, we got to change our mouth. And we got to be careful what we say. I don't want to wish for getting justice for somebody that's murdered. I don't want them getting murdered in the first place. And we should be able to walk down the street and not deal with the psychological inferiority of some white guy decide I'm going to take you out today and then have to clean up the aftermath. If we're going to really deal with the psychological issue and the mental health issue, when we can actually do the same things with the same level of risk that everybody else has, now we're talking. But the problem is we can do it, but I'm getting tired of always having to, you know, duck and weave just so I can go to the same store that you walking through, do, 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 do. You know what I mean? So when we can deal with it on the same level, with the same level of risk, same outcome for the same participation level, then you're going to have some.
Appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. And first of all, I want to say this is a beautiful panel, and I agree with what's been said by everyone. You know, when we look at the issues that we face as a people, both male and female, they're the same. You can argue that one suffer from this more and one suffer from this more, and one children suffer from this more. But we as a people are all victimized because we want her all hurt and regardless. But what the issue is that Carter G. Woodson, who is the father of Black History Month, and I appreciate you, Sandra, bringing up this is Woman History Month. And we at the Culture Center, we call it Black Woman History, Black History Month Phase 2, Black Woman Focus. He talked about miseducation, and the miseducation is not they're not teaching us how to read, write, and count. The miseducation is, and it's not just the public schools. that we went to. It's our home because our parents didn't know how to teach us to deal with what we were facing. They did not understand the institutions that circumvent personal prejudice. In other words, most people see racism as somebody not liking you because of your color or something. Whereas it's an institutional thing. Mm-hmm. You know, hospitals practice segregation. Courts practice disparities. Health facilities practice disparities. And it was in their policies and their practice that we don't take blacks here. We don't do this. And so, you know, our struggle is that how do we educate our children to face the reality they're going to face? You know, the reality of our true condition. I mean, you have a lot of things that contribute to women feeling, I mean, you know, emptiness, you know, being mistreated by some men, being abandoned by men, a single parent raising 3 and 4 kids with different fathers sometimes with the same father who's not living up to his responsibility, causing depression, loneliness, emptiness, not the family institution support that they need. That sister that was a model and an actress and a TV host, she just jumped off a building.
Yeah.
You understand? You say she had money, she had fame, she had everything. And I'm just saying that culture is the ritualization of your existence, and you develop practices. In other words, we don't have to eat what white folks eat. Just because they go to McDonald's, we don't have to go there. Muslims, black Muslims, and Muslim period, they don't eat pork, even though there are pork factories everywhere. If we practice a cultural dynamic that says, hey, look, we got to take care of our bodies is our temple and our minds and things of this nature, it may cut down on the drug abuse, it may cut down on the obesity, it may cut down on the loneliness and the frustration and the self-hatred that you're taught indirectly and directly through institutions and practices that create an inferiority aspect. Now, what you brought out, Sandra, is excellent. But there are people like Carolyn was doing, Carolyn Bush, she's working in the psychological thing. She's trying to find solutions. Kelly did. And we look at all the institutions that we have where people are fighting back and trying to deal with drug addiction, loneliness, suicide, all the issues that we face from a health standpoint, mentally, spiritually, and physically. And I just think that it's commendable for us to have this dynamic of discussion on health with the woman, but we can't erase the black male either because
I agree.
They got to go hand in hand.
There's
two sides of truth, a female and a male.
I agree.
And if you only go with just half, you're going to get an F. You got to come together and be a whole. So this is a good discussion. That's the only thing I'm saying.
Okay. I just want to, I skipped this. One thing we were talking about, black women. And like I was saying, we talked about this doctor who was a doctor who went to medical school. So, I mean, you know, who obviously was a smart woman and she was treated like this in the hospital. So another thing was Serena Williams. You know, she was going through her pregnancy and she kept telling the doctor, something's wrong. Something's wrong. I'm in pain. Something's not right. They kept dismissing her. They kept dismissing her until finally she's like, look, somebody's going to have to do something because it's getting ready to be on. So I'm telling you, something is wrong with me. You guys need to figure this out and you need to figure it out now. So lo and behold, she had developed a pulmonary embolism after the surgery and had a blood clot that was in her lungs. And this is Serena Williams. I mean, you know, she's known worldwide. She's not just, you know, a Compton chick anymore. She's well traveled. She's well versed. She's the GOAT of tennis. And she's being treated and dismissed like this. So if Serena Williams can be ignored and dismissed, then Sandra Rogers, Lisa Kelly, Alexa Kelly, Regina, you know, I mean, the issues that women are saying, how the end men are saying, how they're being treated by the medical system, obviously is true. Okay. So talk a little bit about the cultural competence. So it's cultural competence, and then you have cultural humility, which is what Ms. Beach was trying to focus on. So the goals is building an understanding of different cultures. Cultural humility encourages personal reflection and growth to increase cultural awareness of service providers. The values, knowledge training. She said introspection and co-learning. Cultural competence based on academic knowledge rather than lived experience. Cultural humility and exploration with no endpoint. Cultural competence promotes skill building, establishes minimum performance expectations in clinical practice. Cultural humility encourages lifelong learning with an appreciation of the journey, attempts to lessen destructive dynamics. So the principles, lifelong commitment to critical self-reflection, self-evaluation and critique, commitment to challenging power imbalances, and accepts responsibility to engage in actions that eliminate institutional discrimination. As what is cultural humility in a medical model? So she was saying that a medical staff has to give up the concept of I'm the expert and adopt a care experience as a partnership. And the other one is you might be the expert, but I'm the expert over Sandra Rogers. I'm the expert over Peter Rogers. I'm the expert over Lisa Kelly. And the medical system needs to understand and look at that. Cultural humility teaches us that the story is still being written through shared knowledge and experience of none of us, and none of us will have the whole story on our own. Declaring racism as a public health crisis. And to see us, to see women, to see men, to see Black women, to see Black men. And it says, the sun does not ask permission to shine, and neither do I. So we shine ourselves, we rise ourselves, we empower ourselves. We have to do that because as a people, we are a strong force in everything we do. Black people excel in everything we do. And that's why that's why people fear us. That's why white people fear us. Do you know how powerful we are? And white people know how powerful we can be. And we just need to know how powerful we can be as women, as men, as Black women, as Black men, as a culture. And that is my presentation for this evening. How do I get back to, let's see. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. And Diane says, health inequity is really a Black issue. Oh, hey, Regina, you took your hair. Oh, look at you. Okay.
Okay. Well, before we end this evening, let's go around and see if anybody have a question or a comment. So we're going to start as Women's History Month, Black Women's History Month. So let's go to, we'll start off let's go with Regina. She was here first. Yes. Question or comment?
Well, being a healthcare professional, you know, I have a loud dog over here. That's what I'm dealing with. To figure out, I hear the truth of what you're saying, but I also question the practicality of enacting or the seems like the girl that presented the presentation has a lot of theories that what needs to be done, but because I worked in a predominantly white hospital, it's kind of like you have to almost make yourself as a committee of one to dispel the myths that are permeated in the other society or other culture to let them know our value. We have to become advocates for our fellow brothers and sisters and parents, because even like my grandmother, you know, she's been gone many years, but I couldn't figure out why she kept being sleepy. Granny, why are you sleepy, sleepy, sleepy? Come to find out she had been to so many doctors, they're all giving her the same drug, you know, too much phenobarbital. So sometimes there has to be somebody who has a knowledge base who can inform other people about some of the things that they can do. And another thing, you know, there's so many things I can say. You have to remember, too, that doctors are no longer working for themselves. They're working for insurance companies. So their thing is to keep the bottom line low and to keep you going through the system. But I think I heard something you say, and I thought it was very good, is that the dominant or the predominant society, the white mindset, however you guys want to choose it, considers Black people or wasteful and foolish to commit resources to them. So therefore, there are inadequacies in availability and the quality. And that's even seen in our food. I didn't know that there were categories of food, A, B, C, and D. So you can have the same salad, you know, from Dole Company, but when it's in a Black community, it's the leftover denurtured part where you go over to the blonder side of town and you get a better quality of food. So it's a myriad of things, as many facets, but I think we have to figure out how we, in our own sphere of influence, can help dispel some of the myths to make it more okay. Am I making any sense?
So that's it, and I
see a lot, but I think the whole healthcare system is bad, and really with mental health, because that's why we have the issue we have here in LA with the people on the streets, you know, and the system is not geared to help them. And I applaud the lady that's from DC, because at least there's a program that, you know, can come follow them through. I don't know what you have, you know, Sandra, you may know, but there's nothing there. And we have a 30, 72 hour hold, and you just put them back on the streets again.
Right.
And, you know, they killed a lady here, you know, a couple of months ago, right here on the corner, trying to get to work. And so now they're trying to enact some system that we're going to mandatorily place these people somewhere so they can be mandated to follow, be followed up. Let's just see, you know, so I hate to say I'm kind of like jaded, but it's a lot of talk.
Yeah,
you know, and so that's my comment.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Okay, you're welcome.
Ms. Carolyn Bush, Sandra, would you like to introduce Ms. Carolyn Bush again, because I know she has a rich history that people can appreciate.
Right,
I ain't saying that the rest of us don't.
Carolyn, you know you're on mute, right? Take yourself off mute.
Let me see. Okay, I ask her to unmute.
I think I've done it. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hey, yes.
I was really kind of glad to be on mute because I was afraid my dog would start barking. it's been very interesting. I was very, very impressed with the young lady that spoke regarding mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
She addressed a lot of issues that really need to be addressed among the Black community. We've got to recognize that mental illness does exist, that it is real, and that we've got to get rid of the stigma that surrounds it and acknowledge the fact, because you cannot, unless you own something, you really cannot do anything about it. And we are going to have to own the fact that mental illness is real in the Black community.
Right. That's right.
Okay, Sandra, can you tell us a little bit about Ms. Bush here?
I would love to. This is my first cousin, Carolyn Bush. And some of you already know, but some of you guys are new tonight. So Carolyn was a freedom rider for the civil rights movement. She was jailed with
John Lewis.
Yeah, John Lewis and Vivian, right?
Yeah, C.T. Vivian.
C.T. Vivian. She was jailed with them. She rode with them. She was trained by John Lewis. John Lewis was a very close friend.
Diane Nash.
Very close friend of hers. She's just a phenomenal woman. And I'm glad that she's family.
I'm glad that she's here. Excellent.
Oh,
beautiful, beautiful. Okay, we're going to go to the elder Kelly, and then we're going to go back to the not elder Kelly.
I just want to say, Alexis, very well spoken. I'm really proud of you. That's why I said some of them college dollars went in a good place.
Yes, they did.
But just to add to a couple of things that you guys were saying about, especially with what Regina said, I will concur with what she said. And I will just tell you this, that my younger daughter is a police officer in L.A. County. And one of the things that she just discussed with me a couple days ago was when they arrest someone, they put them on a 72-hour hold. And she said, Mom, that lady was just bat crazy. I said, well, what happened to her? She said, well, they just put her on a 72-hour hold. They're going to let her go, and she's going to be back on the street committing the same crime over and over. She said, you know what? I'm going to see her in a couple days, and we're going to have to arrest her again. And it's a cycle. And Regina, you spoke to me when you said that because I thought it's futile. Like, it's futile. And how do we dispel some of these things that are going on? Like I said, I know that's a fact because my kid just told me that that's what they do on a nightly basis. So you tell me about the mental health side of things. I don't know how it gets better. And I'll just leave it at that. Alexis, you may want to jump in.
No pressure. I mean, these are the topics that I engage in again daily. And I look at it, I challenge myself. I was telling my supervisor today, I said, I want to be able to critically think. So please provide me with tasks that would allow me to do so. I said, I think I've adopted the routine of what you're requiring me to do, but I'm asking you to please allow me to be challenged further because I said, I recognize that we're working in a cyclical system in the first place. When you like was already shared with Ms. Regina shared, I work in a community. It's a predominantly low-income Black community. I don't find a grocery store. I don't see a health store. I mean, there is very minimal resources in that area. The streets are nasty. The people there could care less, too. You just see it. They're born and raised here. This is exactly what you see. What you see is what you get. All I do is go over a bridge. I live 1 mile away from where I work, night and day. There's new condos being built as we speak, about 3 new condos being built running for almost $500,000. $500,000. I got grocery stores. I have a bank. I have multiple restaurants. I have public transit easily accessible. I have clean streets. I have parks to walk my dogs. And they're talking a mere mile away from one another. And when I lived in LA, I lived in Long Beach, worked in San Pedro. It was the same. When I went to work, I'm walking past dirty needles on the street. I'm walking past homeless individuals. It was a very unsanitary public health crisis in and of itself. And then I go home and I walk by the water. And so that's been my world. And so ultimately, it's the money. If they don't see you as valuable, they're certainly not going to put money to you as a value. So this homeless crisis, They're not paying for people to get off the street just to not do well in the house. They're just going to say, we're going to get you off the street because visually it just doesn't look very good. But we have no real programs to help allow people to successfully be housed. There's many people being housed without the ability to pay a bill. They've never had to, they never had their own check or bank account. It's very common for clients of mine to have their first bank account because they've been using Cash App for all transactions. As I already shared before, people are not paying taxes, so they don't even know what that experience is like. And so it's one thing to get people off the street because it doesn't look great. It's another thing for them to be successful in the process. In order to do that, you have to have money for that. And you have to have money for that. You have to have the staffing for that. And you have to have people who are willing to work with that population. There is a population, I mean, there is a homeless crisis and there's a mental health crisis within that. But what you're also having to discuss is the substance abuse issues that are going to be paramount. No one wants to pay for people using drugs to get in a home that their taxes have to pay for them to continue using drugs. So then you have that social stigma as well. And so, and then you don't know which one came first, a chicken or the egg. Was there a mental health issue before a drug issue? Is a drug issue exacerbated a mental health issue? You don't really know. And unfortunately, the subjective stigmatizing beliefs are what's predicating people to stay on the street and not be able to find real work because they don't have the access or the means to do so. And it's by design. It's a systematic design. The right. same way I have clients who have spent their whole life on government assistance because it's by design. I've seen people, my clients do better with income from the government than they do working. They will get a minimum wage job, but the income they receive from their children as dependents and the Section 8 and then this and that, they actually do just fine. And it's all by design. So I think there's a lot of different layers to be discussed. And I'm glad that some were touched on today. And I'm just so happy to know that there are people who get it and who are also trying to have creative ways of advocacy. I just started working at a hospital over the weekends. And so now I'm challenged myself. I literally woke up, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, I think I want to work at a hospital because I'm ready for that level of challenge and intrigue. And so now I'm hopefully going to be able to see the other side of it. But I've already been working at the hospital for a month. It's the bottom line. There is on everybody's medical records, once you go past a certain day of your length of stay, it becomes red and it's an alert to tell you basically they need to get out. It's regardless of whatever they're in for. It's an alert to tell you they've been here too long. And so if that's the case, God forbid we actually have adequate treatment. If the bottom line is telling you actually need to get them out as soon as possible and you're penalized, should they return to care within a certain period? So I just think that there's a lot of things going on. And what I'm learning through my very brief time in this field is money.
Right.
Money. And until the Black body is valued the same as the white body, unfortunately, we're chasing after something that's fleeting. But I try to keep hope alive, and I thank God for the fact that I have the hope that I do. But certainly, this is the reality of the situation, and my faith in that change can come is what helps drive me to keep going to work every day.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. That is excellent. Keep doing it.
Excellent. Excellent.
Excellent.
Brother Doctor?
Excellent presentation. Some more good information. Can't wait till you come on next time.
Okay. We gonna get them on.
Yeah, but you know, Alexi is right, though. It is. It's by design. You know, everything with healthcare is by design, and it's all about money. And it's all about who has the purse strings and who thinks a certain population deserves the healthcare that they need. And it's simple as that, because where I work, right across the street from MLK Hospital, and in my district in Spa 6, you know, like I think I've said before, girls, Black girls ages 12 to 24, gonorrhea is just flowing. I mean, the rate of gonorrhea between Black girls in my community between ages 12, in 24 is off the charts. But ain't no money for them. They don't want, as long as the girls are being treated, they don't want the girls to be educated. They don't want, they don't care about the sex partners being treated. They don't care that the girls are going to get reinfected over and over and over again. That's not an issue. It's no money going to education. It's no money going to prevention for black girls ages 12 or 24. There's money going to HIV and AIDS, and I'm an HIV AIDS women's advocate. So I'm not saying anything about that, but the money is not being evenly distributed. You could give money to the HIV people, but you could also give money to the black girls who has HIV, you know, and I screamed from the rooftops. And I remember even talking to a black doctor about this issue. And what he told me was, if you get enough girls who get gonorrhea to the point where they're hospitalized, then Sandra, people may pay attention. But just saying, oh, look, these girls got gonorrhea, we got to do something about it. No. If they're hospitalized with PID or they have an ectopic pregnancy, then, and it got to be a good amount of them now, then if I come to the table being an angry black woman, then they'll listen. But just black girls 12 years old, 13 years old, 14, haven't gotten real. Oh, well, if they treat it, they treat it. Don't waste your money talking to them. Don't waste your money educating. And those are things that really have to change. And it's ridiculous. The disparities in certain communities are by design. You know, it's not just by circumstance. They want us to stay down. They don't want us educated. They don't want us treated. You know, it's just the money's not there for that. But we have to, as a people, we're the ones who have to educate these black girls to speak up, to get empowered, to say, no, this is not right. No, I need help. No, the white girl over at Hamilton High School, she need the black girl over here, Jordan and Watts, we need to be treated the same damn way. Point blank, period. There's no reason that Jordan High School and Watts don't have a health teacher and ain't had a health teacher. And I'm at the table talking about, well, where the hell is a health teacher? When Pacific Palisades got a health teacher, Hamilton High School got a health teacher. Damn, Dorsey got a damn health teacher. Why over here in Watts and Jordan High School, we can't get a damn health teacher? What the? And everybody's okay with that? No. So, you know, this is a whole nother topic that we go at, but we almost at an hour and a half. So I appreciate being on again. I appreciate sharing the information. You know, I'm happy everybody came on and gave their input. It was very powerful and it was very impactful. And, you know, we're just going to continue to do the work.
All right. You are my co-host. So that leaves Professor Rye out and Peter out for ending comment or question. Right. So we're gonna save it for next time. Everybody, I'm very appreciative of you coming on here and sharing your information. And we're going to keep doing this and we want solutions. So we need to think about more solutions. And I think that this forum is a solution, because we're getting information out there and we're giving some ideas where people could get educated and learn about these things. And I'm excited. That's all. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Next week, we have one of my daughters coming on. I'm going to interview her. So that should be interesting. And, you know, I know Sandra brings out a lot of people, so you guys are always welcome to come on Mondays and Wednesdays and participate. We have shows on every week. We got Professor Amin Ra with Conscious Corner, him and Joe Hembrick. And then today on Wednesdays, we have myself and Professor Amin Ra, Peter. Peter comes every now and again. So we just want to keep doing what we're doing. And like Professor Ra say, it's going to grow. Mm-hmm. Okay, Professor Ra, who we got for Monday?
We got Rinaldo Brown, who went to Compton High. He was a high school Olympian. He just finished a book, How I Got Over. And he talks about health, because he had a kidney transplant twice. And he went over there in 1968 as a high school person, and he got a book out called How I Got Over. And the most essential thing is that the best cure to any problem is prevention. And I want to say a salute to all of y'all that are working in the health field and working with Black people to teach them, despite all the disparities, despite racism, we still rise. And we still got people doing things on their own. They're not waiting on public health and all of that. They're giving advice and they're helping people as much as they can. And that's how we're able to be where we are today. We're standing on other people's shoulders. And many Black women contributed to it. You understand? As they brought out Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, Mary Bethune, you know, built the first colleges. Despite all the stuff that white folks do, or whoever do it, it's for us to respond. And y'all are doing a great job in your various professions and your lifestyle, being an example of excellence to young girls who see how you live and how you're able to do the things you do and get your education, regardless of all the barriers and the commitment that it took. So you and people following your footprints. So this is an excellent presentation, and I hope that y'all continue to do what you do. Sante sana.
All right, thanks, Professor Ra. All right, everybody, Conscious Corner, and each one teach one.
All right.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks, guys. I'm going to call you, Regina. Thanks, Carolyn.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Love
Bye,
you.
Y'all. Bye. Night, night.